Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Come and take a photo of Montserrat, says her mother Maria, seeing me with a camera one day. She's all ready for her first day at school. I do, as the smiling Monsie proudly unzips her pencil case and lays out its contents carefully on a rock for the photo, arranging herself next to it with her new plastic backpack and zip-up windcheater. As I take the picture, I see her bright eyes and the big smile fighting self-consciousness to slide across her clean, scrubbed face. It's only later that I look at the copy of the photo I've kept for myself and see the treasure she has assembled, ready to tackle school, are 8 half-used pencils, an old eraser, a sharpener, and 3 stubs of crayon. I look again at her beaming face. There are so many kids in primary schools here. Some of them have to run a double day. Some of the kids coming from 8 till 12:30, then the others attending from 1 till 5:30. I'd once asked some school kids early in the morning why they were hurrying to school when there was still an hour to spare. "We want to get a seat," they'd said. The gear the members' children need to buy to go to secondary school here, a backpack, pencils, textbooks, new shirt and shoes, costs about $15 US. The temptation to put my hand in my pocket and solve this problem every time I see a mother depositing 30 cents for their child is overwhelming. But it's not fair, my workmates tell me. If you can't do it for all of them, don't do it for any of them. You'll only create division. $15 to make sure a kid gets a chance to go to school. 25 million kids or thereabouts who could really use that money. Per capita income, $4,440. Foreign debt to the US is a figure so ludicrous, it only gets stupider the more you say it. Try it. $155,000 million. That's what they say. The rescue package from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank a few years ago, which sold off major public assets like railways, electricity plants and airports, was called an austerity program. There's 630 people for every doctor. Why do these women sit and listen to me so politely and respectfully when I lecture them on foods they've barely seen, let alone could afford? I visit someone's house with a questionnaire to fill out. The householder's arms are covered in soapy water from doing the family wash in the outdoor trough. "Come in," she says delightedly, as she invites me into her bare yard. "Mi casa es su casa." My house is your house. She asks me to wait under the one tree while she brings her 2 chairs from the house. We sit on them and she calls to her daughter doing her homework to go to the shop for some drinks. The girl disappears into the house to get money, trots out the gate, then returns with a bottle of Coca-Cola. Her mother pours it into plastic cups, hands one to me, and settles herself into her chair. "This is the life, isn't it?" she says with a smile. I recognise in myself a reflexive impulse to see other people's chronic hardships in terms of how many dollars it would take to fix. But I realise that's only seeing part of the problem. I've seen the savings books. I know exactly what stands between these people and destitution. I think part of me doesn't want to believe what's staring me in the face. Here before me, every day, is evidence of what's possible. These people only survive on so little. They create a whole life, a whole world with it. In that world, there's birth and death, success and failure, hope and joy, quite a lot of dancing, happy, excitable kids and warm hospitality. I've been taught you need something for that kind of life, which patently isn't here. At Urak, where money and debt are constantly on the agenda, I don't think I've ever heard anybody use the word pobre, poor, to describe themselves. That word is reserved for objects of pity, or thin animals, or victims of the hurricane in Honduras. Usually, they say they falta dinero, they lack money. I look at the contented face before me. She is perfectly well aware of what she has to give me. 20 minutes of shady rest, a chair, a cool drink, a chat, an opportunity of respite raised by a questionnaire. I'm a guest here, and she's a hostess. How mean-spirited it would be to insist upon paying for the Coke. I raise my cup to her. This is the life, I agree. The high-protein cereal we give out to the underweight children in the nutrition program is made from a grain called amaranth, an indigenous seed extremely high in protein and amino acids, 13 times as nutritious as corn, in fact. It had always been used in ritual feasts by the Aztecs when the Spanish arrived. In fact, at sacrifices it was apparently mixed with human blood and moulded into little effigies and figures, eaten and offered as tributes to the gods. The Spanish nearly blew a gasket when they saw this. Amaranth, because it was utilised in a way which seemed a little too close to the Eucharistic host for comfort, was labelled satanic and devil's food. No Indian was permitted to grow it, and it teetered perilously close to extinction. Now, it's heralded as one of the most nutritious grains on the planet. Now the Mexican government's sponsoring its distribution, handing it back in parcels to the malnourished indigenous children of Chiapas as a miracle panacea. Something banned as evil becomes something vital, something celebrated, and this pattern is everywhere. A Greek friend told me once that when her grandmother first came to Australia, she had to buy olive oil at the chemist. If our acceptance of multicultural foods in Australia seems based on a history of grudging reluctance, it's instructive to remember that when the potato arrived in Europe, it was avoided. Rumours claimed it caused leprosy. Plenty of people in Australia are there because of the population boom in Ireland caused by its introduction and the exodus precipitated by the blight which hit it, causing hundreds of thousands to starve or emigrate. That's happening now to others, though, and we're not so keen to romanticise it. Lately, I've been considering anew the waves of resistance to migrant groups in Australia. I've had to. News of someone called Pauline Hanson sweeping the Queensland election has made international news, and every European and Canadian I meet keeps asking me to explain. Oorak's being visited by some workers from Swiss and French aid agencies. It's the first thing they ask us too, when they find out we're Australian. Unexpectedly and awkwardly cast as an impromptu cultural ambassador, I feel like a North American abroad in the 60s, trying to justify and encompass the existence of Mississippi into the image of my country. We're a democracy, I say hesitantly. We're a young country, struggling for identity. We don't have a historical precedent. But even as I speak, I know I'm bluffing. We have plenty of historical precedents. We're just choosing to ignore them. In Mexico, racial prejudice like alcoholism, pollution, and the ravages of transnational corporations is one of the things which seems more obvious and obnoxious to a Westerner only because it's more transparently in your face. It's one of our many luxuries in the first world that we can pretty much hide those things from ourselves, however costly that disguise may be. It's a price we're prepared to pay to sustain our illusions. Public events flatter us by telling us that simply by attending we are, as a matter of course, celebrating cultural diversity. Someone comes once a week and takes our garbage away on our behalf and dumps it out of sight. Corporations advertise constantly, assuring us that they're behaving responsibly at home and abroad. We make the mistake of feeling smugly reassured only because we pay a kind of shut-up money to keep all this stuff out of our line of vision. That door stays shut until someone like Hanson comes along with the key. Then we pretend shock and outrage about what it swings open to reveal. Our shock rings about as hollow as pretending that we don't know where the shit on Bondi Beach could have come from. My workmate Murray Cruz tells me a story one day. Someone has donated some bolts of waterproof material to Uruk, and a great deal of discussion has taken place about how to distribute it fairly. Finally, we've organised to pay some members with overlockers who do piecework for the Playtex factory to sew this fabric into backpacks for child members and then to sell them for a nominal amount in the shop. A simple donation has taken a huge amount of extra logistical work to be utilised, and I say I can't see why we couldn't have just given the fabric to the members with the machines and let them sell the backpacks themselves. We can't show any favouritism, says Murray Cruz. It's for the same reason we can't create disharmony. She tells me that about 15 years ago, a nationwide program was implemented called Solidarity, through which the government addressed unemployment and lack of resources in one fell swoop, by providing towns with materials to build their own public buildings. As well as bags of cement and bricks, they assessed the most impoverished, marginalised families in each of those towns involved in Solidarity and provided a temporary kind of food voucher system where those families received a discount on tortillas, say, or milk. Today, ORAC often holds meetings in that one community room in town, constructed, as a sign painted on the wall will say, with Solidarity. ORAC conducted a survey once, Murray Cruz goes on, trying to establish what assets each of the communities had in terms of washing facilities, telephones, taps, sealed roads and so on. To get a better idea of what community-owned buildings there were, one of the questions had been, what did the Solidarity Project leave your community with? Unprompted, nearly a third of respondents had written, envy. I go to a savings meeting not long after this. It's Murray Cruz's birthday, and coincidentally 5 years since the town's been involved in the union. She enlists me to help to get the banking done quickly, to get on with the community party. Women arrive with the ubiquitous blue enamel pots and bundles wrapped up in clean tea towels, ready for this feast. But something in the meeting causes a snag. There's a dispute between five women over who is next in line for a loan. One woman sticks to her guns and claims it's her. The others quietly insist they've all been waiting too. She cites her need for the money, and the others nod, saying, I hear you, but we're all in the same boat. We're all waiting, and we all have projects. Murray Cruz stands her ground and does not offer to intervene on their behalf, and the other 40 or so members stand solidly, not interfering either. An impasse is reached, but nothing is resolved. The women separating uncomfortably, rewrapping their shawls, not speaking. There's an unfamiliar tension in the air, of unaddressed business and hurt feelings, which nobody seems to know how to handle. The isolated woman moves away to stand with her mother, mutinously, all her stress in her teeth as she chews and chews her gum. There's nowhere to go. The matriarchs who brought the food are annoyed that the party's been delayed by such unpleasant business, and glance glumly at the defensive, unbending postures of the five women in conflict. Other members confer with each other again, shaking their heads, their eyes bright and strained. Suddenly, the lids are taken off the saucepans, the tacos are laid out, serviettes and paper plates appear, and the kids start jumping up and down for a cup of Coca-Cola. Voices are muted, and plates are ladled high with food, too much food, as if this abundance of chicken and mole sauce and rice and piled plates could salve the strain of the bad feeling we've all witnessed. A big cake, a surprise for Murray Cruz, is cut, and the kids all get little moulded jellies. The dissenting woman stands wretchedly, her jaw set and her face stony. Then as it gets dark, there's a moment of dusk which falls into place, as necessary as sunset. One of the four women meets the eye of the stubborn arguer, still flexing her jaw on gum, standing miserable and alone. Hey, she says, and holds out a plate. There's 4 seconds of hell breath. Then the woman by the fence smiles, moves her clenched arms apart, and steps forward. Which is harder, would you say? The giving or the taking? The offering or the accepting? I know suddenly as I stand there that I want for myself and for my own world something of the courage this takes. Not just the courage to hold out the plate, but the courage to move forward to take it. I stand with my plate of cooling, lovingly prepared food, witness to such necessary, painful compromise, and all that it asks of us.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.